That's Jamaica's Jimmy Cliff with Sooner or Later. It's from his 1973 album, Struggling Man. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And today is a year to the day that St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCullough announced that a grand jury found no reason to charge then-officer Darren Wilson with any crimes related to his killing of Michael Brown, 18, in Ferguson, Missouri. Today is the day in Chicago where a police officer, Jason Van Dyke, has been charged with the first-degree murder of Laquan McDonald, 17, in a similar case. Much is being made of this case, and of course this is typical in such cases where there is a concerted effort to over-dramatize the fact that simple justice is proceeding. It should be a cut-and-dried event. It should be expected that the wheels of justice should turn. But just so you know, this shooting of Laquan McDonald occurred on October the 20th last year. And only now has there been a charge associated with this crime against the police officer involved. And why? The wheels of justice do not turn predictably for certain communities. And when they do, a huge public relations event is mounted to say, see? See? Justice does occur. Justice does happen. But let's take a look, shall we, at the numerous cases that we know of where these cases follow a predictable path, and it is one of legal obstruction, legal impediments, cover-ups, complete corruption, prosecutorial misconduct, judicial misconduct, and indifference by the systems, the various systems that should be keeping tabs on these cases, and that should encourage in these communities, these targeted and affected communities, a sense that justice is in fact for all. But that doesn't work. Here is this case in which a police officer is seen on the dash cam of his police car confronting a 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, who is said at the time to be acting erratically. And later it was discovered in an autopsy that he might have been on some kind of a hallucinogenic drug at the time, and he was carrying a small knife, a penknife or something like that sort, and was told to drop it, and he didn't, and began walking away from the police officer, Jason Van Dyke. Van Dyke, with McDonald's back turned to him as he was walking away, shoots him in the back twice, then gets to the fallen McDonald, who's on the ground now, and pumps 14 more bullets into this young man's body. Now, had the dash cam not recorded that, had that evidence not been available, had the word of eyewitnesses been the only way to substantiate or to determine what had happened there, independent of other forensic evidence, the standard procedure would have been to say the witnesses were not credible. Eyewitnesses, African American and Latino eyewitnesses, are not credible. And it would have gone a predictable route. And they did try that, because it took this long, these many months, more than a year, for the wheels of justice to turn predictably. And just follow the rules, just follow the law. Nothing extraordinary was demanded here. But it became an extraordinary demand in the first instance because this particular problem usually involves the power of the state through the agency of a white police officer or white police officers against politically unprotected communities and individuals, most often African American and Latino males. That's the typical scenario. And the result has been extraordinarily consistent. No justice. The police officers are found to have acted well within departmental guidelines, they would say, as if departmental guidelines have anything at all to do with the crime of murder. Under the color of departmental guidelines, police officers are given even more latitude, greater consideration, and greater dispensation from justice, because they wear the uniform, which is symbolic of the power of the state, not to mention the fact that they're members of police unions, and police unions are notoriously effective in intimidating people into rendering the expected decision. The expected decision usually is the exculpation of the police officer or officers involved, and basically the determination, without it being tested in a court of law, that whoever was the victim of violence and even lethal force pretty much asked for it. They did not recognize, or they flouted, the authority of the state, and the state, via the authority of the police officer, who is vested with that power and authority by wearing the uniform, took summary action, and the officer is at once judge, jury, and executioner. Yes, we will get all the platitudes, as we did in this particular case, from Mayor Rahm Emanuel in Chicago. You know, it was so unfortunate, and it was, our thoughts and prayers, the silly catchphrases that pop up with alarming regularity when these things happen. But in the end, there is no further that these cases will go. So, more than a year. And we are just getting the result that should have been automatic and basic standard. This should not be such an extraordinary event in that sense. A police officer appear to have broken the law, appear to have taken the life of a young man for no justifiable reason. It shouldn't be an extraordinary thing. It shouldn't really amount to such an extraordinary event in the sense of the criminal justice system working. The criminal justice system works to great precision and effect when the tables are turned, with predictable results. Those results usually involving, by any means necessary, the charging and the trial and conviction and incarceration and even the execution of the offender. So we take a look at this. The reason we have in this particular case in Chicago, the reason that we have something approximating justice, however grudgingly given, however slow to come, the fact is that it was because the community that is affected, or the community where this particular crime resonated more so than in any other community, they are no longer silent. They're no longer bystanders and tourists in their own experiences. And they have been emboldened most recently by what happened in Ferguson, the killing of Michael Brown, and the reaction that that got, not just in Ferguson, Missouri, but across the nation. It educated people about the nature of the relationship between these politically unprotected communities and the power of the state, and the tendency and the almost a guarantee of the corruptibility of that system, and its inability or its unwillingness to deliver justice. So there has been an awakening. It came at the expense, again, of black life. And it again reminded us of this power equation that we have been living with in this country for hundreds of years. But it was a definitive turning point in the collective consciousness of people that we will not tolerate this anymore, and we are willing now not just to mobilize, but to mobilize in a particular way to affirm our specific power, our concerns, and our demands. But here again, because this young man died at the age of 17, we see the story again unfolding, reminding us that we are targeted people. What would inform this police officer that he had the right, simply because he wore a uniform and a badge? And we come to this question all the time. What informs that person's mentality and conduct to think that this is something he can do, and more than likely with impunity? It is because there has been no consistent consequences to a system that protects such individuals, makes sure that the power equation is not altered at all. And we will hear, as we did in this case, well, this officer just, Rahm Emanuel, as a matter of fact, the mayor just about said that this officer just violated trust at every level. In other words, he delivered what could easily be called a verdict himself. Well, on the one hand, one would say, well, that's a new one. That's good. On the other hand, it is simply a mayor who has ignored the demand for more than a year for justice, who, on the basis of the mounting evidence against the police officer, and who, if he allowed all of this to go unchecked, would be responsible for whatever conflagration would start out, would be touched off because of this event, this tragedy, he will bear the responsibility. So he takes a calculated guess at what it is he ought to do, and the easier thing to do would be to give this cop up. He will not be protected. They made the decision. It looks too bad. We can't defend this one, so we will give him up. And when we do that, we get to claim the purity, our political purity. We gain the trust of the African-American community, as if this were all about trust. It's not about trust. It's about follow the law. African-American communities are expected to be grateful for the fact that people are supposed to be following the law. In white communities, this is automatic. You're not doing anybody any favors. This is what is to be done. So get it done. How many cases have we seen where we can intuitively tell that there's something grossly wrong, grotesquely wrong here, but still we have a community insisting, let us follow the law. Let it proceed according to the law, a law that they have no reason to trust based on history, a law that is openly and unapologetically biased and racist and prejudiced and unfair and unbalanced. They have no reason at all to put their faith in a system that has so consistently betrayed the people's trust, but they do. And still they get no justice. People have to take to the streets. People have to embarrass the nation before the world. People have to volunteer for arrest. People have to make sacrifices to get just the basics of supposedly a just system to work. And now, the price again, once again, paid in blood for fairness, we still here at base one. We haven't yet moved off of base one. And that is, a cop has killed a person. And the cop should be brought to justice, and justice should be swift, and justice should be immediate, and justice should be predictable. But they stalled it for more than a year. I told you later last week, of a story in Miami occurring 4 years ago. A young Haitian man cut down by as many as 12 police officers in a hail of 116 bullets 4 years ago. And there are no answers. And there's no accountability. And there's no prosecution. And there's no questioning. And there's no report. and there's no investigation that yields a report. And there is no loss of jobs. There's no forfeiting of retirement. There's nobody being called on the carpet. There's nobody being fired about it. Even the basics have not been met. And they don't even care to make it look that at least we've done the basics. 4 years ago, it was captured by several witnesses using their cell phones, their cell phone cameras. And still, the system is maintaining in a way that that's not credible evidence. We need something more. When these stories appear, they appear as just, well, they're news stories. But they're also propaganda stories. And they're stories that are supposed to remind us time and again, all of America, about the state, the rotten state of affairs that we live with and live in. This 17-year-old man came from a family too. He was somebody's son and perhaps a brother, a friend. And whatever people want to say about this young man who is now deceased, whatever it is they want to say about him, here's an incontrovertible fact. He is dead, and he shouldn't be. And the only reason, based on what we are presented with as the preliminary facts of this case, the only reason he is dead is because he's a black man in America. That's it. The only reason that this young man is dead is that he is a black man in the United States of America. How's that for an assertion? And I dare somebody to challenge me on that. And he is dead for the same reason that his grandfather and great-great-grandfather and great-great-great-grandfather and going back generations all had to live through threats to their lives on the basis of the fact that they are black men in the United States of America. Well, some would say he's dead because, well, he broke the law. And the law responded. And the police officer reacted, and perhaps he was a little, quote, overzealous, unquote, but he certainly was operating under the color and authority of the police department in keeping in check a young man who had the temerity to walk away from him when he issued an order. And you will die because I have the authority to kill you and end your life. In the United States of America, the country we're reminded all the time about freedom and democracy and the freedom from fear and freedom from tyranny. And they will tell us this is not a terrorist state and this is not a terrorist act. It is simply a police officer performing his job. He might have been a little bit overzealous, but in the end, he was being a police officer, and that matters more than this young man's life. But that's the story. That's the story of the reality of life for many millions of people in the United States of America. That is not a story that the media would want to tell. That is not a story that we would study in our sociology classes and anthropology classes in college, But that is the fact of life in America, even in 2015. There's no definitive difference between the political and power arrangement of the system in Laquan McDonald's world than it was in the 1700s or even the late 1600s. No difference. The power equation remains precisely the same. Well, here we have, again, another reminder of how the system works. This is what it does. The illusion that this is also an aspect of our democratic society, that when people do wrong, irrespective of their station in life, irrespective of the color of their skin, irrespective of all the trivial things that and superficial things that divide us, we get serious and we are able to see through all of that and deliver justice. No, it doesn't work that way. Doesn't work that way. And even now, this dash cam that recorded the execution of Laquan McDonald had to be fought for. In this democratic world, they didn't want to give that up. People had to go to court and petition the court to order the release of the dash cam recording of this tragedy, of this execution. That's not gladly given up. No freedom of information applies to black people in this country. Yes, technically this is the public's right to know. This is the First Amendment and all the other things that people quote at you all the time. But these rules do not apply to black people in this country. Even in a situation where a recording can confirm the guilt of an officer, and more so the innocence of the victim in this matter, you have to go to court and fight for that. And the reason that we have the indictment being announced today is that by court order, it has to be released by tomorrow. And for public relations purposes, not for moral purposes, for public relations purposes, in order to stand before Chicago and say, we too join the community in its interest and in the quest for justice, and we will not put any impediments in the path of that, rather than just release the information as they should by law. You shouldn't have to go through court to get that. They will now say, we are interested in everybody knowing the truth, except we know what the truth is. The truth is, you tried your best as a public relations move to preempt the inevitable release of the information by court order, and that court order being the result of a legal action that had to be taken. There's no voluntary action here. They had to be compelled by court to release information that should be no big deal. This is part of the public record. The public has a right to know. First Amendment this and, you know, all this kind of stuff that they typically talk about. Release the information, but no, not here. And not ever in some of these cases, as you see, that we've been discussing here on Lead Stories. I raise these things simply again to remind people, especially since we tend to deal with the moment and we ignore the context of the moment, we ignore the history of the moment, so we get lost. We don't connect things. And we don't see this as a continuum of our reality and therefore a continuum in struggle. We tend to see this, and this is the hope and prayer of the powers that we will see this as a disconnected aberration. This is just something that happened. It's not the norm. The norm is justice, and the norm is fairness, not duplicity, not deliberate impediments, not corruption, not out-and-out racism, not out-and-out apartheid in America, 2015 America, in post-racial Obama's America. But this is just, you know, it's a hiccup, and we will heal. Let's get together, hold hands the way we know we always have, and we will walk through this difficult time together, and we will heal together. That's what they're hoping that we will take away from this horrible, horrible experience. So, in many ways, we have to say to ourselves too that we have to not apologize for the realities that we live, and therefore the unique ways that we have to adjust. We can't possibly believe that as a community, whether geographically located in Chicago, or a community that shares a common history and a common culture, common concerns. You can't possibly think that people who understand that reality should now go with the standard approach to solving the problem. No. Something else is called for. We are not one. We are not the same. We are not all Americans. We are not all protected by the Constitution. We do not all have equal access to these protections. We are not all citizens of this country. Many millions of us remain separate and apart by virtue of our history and by virtue of how we are treated in this country because of that history. And we would do ourselves a great disservice to now morph into this thing called Americans, this term. We shouldn't morph into it at all until we really get to understand how different we are. This is not to say you're hating anybody, but you have to appreciate the uniqueness of your position and your existence and your reality. You have to really get conversant with that. Because if your life depends on it, you would be stupid to assume that adopting all of the trappings of the culture that is doing you in is somehow going to save you. You have to be crazy to think that. But if you understand that you still, in 2015, you are more like Laquan McDonald and more like Michael Brown than not, you have a fighting chance. And that's the work. There are ways in which we can see how we have a role to play in the general scheme of things. But this system does not recognize our membership in that club. The system recognizes our membership in an entirely different club. And so you have to devise your system because it is vital to survival. We'll take this break, and when we come back, we pick up from yesterday's discussion on whatever is it that Bernie Sanders means when he describes himself as a democratic socialist. Right after this.
Pressure is all around. Sit around and hesitate. Say you're waiting for a lucky break. Life for living. Better use your sense. Use what you got from coincidence. Imminent. Sooner or later, you're gonna have to stand up tall. Sooner or later, when your back's against that wall. Sooner or later, you'll have to be the one you are. Or you just might find that you're out of time, and it's just too late.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm your host, Lead Stories by Eutrice Lead. I welcome you to this other segment of the program. We're talking, actually, we're following up yesterday's discussion, got lots and lots of feedback via email on the discussion we began yesterday on what is this thing that Bernie Sanders is talking about, this idea of democratic socialism. Is this something that we need to know more about? Is this something that will, in one way or the other, address the concerns that we have? And if so, how so? Is Bernie Sanders what he says he is, a democratic socialist? Does it matter in this political race where people could be anything they want to be because they're in a tight race for the president in 2016, and so whatever works to differentiate them from their other opponents will work. But for a long time, as you know, Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, has insisted that he is different. He is not your run-of-the-mill Democrat, because he has a different philosophy, and his philosophy he calls democratic socialism. I'm interested in your view. What do you understand it to be? Is this something that has practical application? Is it something that is even achievable? And what has to happen for democratic socialism to take hold? Certainly, Bernie Sanders has identified any number of ways in which he thinks that the United States society can be vastly improved, to be more just, to be more fair, and he has enumerated many ways in which that could be done. And he attributes this to democratic socialism. I have some ideas about it, but I'm trying to find out what he means by it. And even though I've listened to his speeches, and he cites the application of democratic socialism, I'm not so sure about what the philosophy is. What is the undergirding philosophy of democratic socialism? Perhaps you know, or perhaps you are aware of some of the aspects of this philosophy of democratic socialism, and perhaps you can help us understand in what ways it differs from, say, the basic concept of democracy that the Democrats have, or that the Republicans have. In what ways would democratic socialism be like their philosophy, and in what ways would it be unlike their philosophy? But more importantly, what has to happen, in your view, for this philosophy to take hold and translate itself into all of these benefits that Bernie Sanders is talking about? Are you clear about it? I'm puzzled myself, but it certainly is a good conversation to follow up on. 888-874-4888. This is where we stretch out a little bit and figure out, what is he talking about? What do you think he's talking about? And is it possible to achieve all the things he has enumerated with this philosophy of democratic socialism? Is there a place you think that it is being applied? He has time and again referred to other systems in Sweden, mostly Europe, and even in Canada, systems that he says are functioning pretty much within the parameters of democratic socialism. And therefore, if we take our cues from these systems, we may probably achieve a better standard of life, a fairer standard of life in the United States with this philosophy. From White Plains, Sal, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Trace. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I think he's basically made it up, and he's being provocative, and I think it's helping his campaign. And he's pointing out, I think, that you showed in the excerpt that you played yesterday from one of the speeches, that we already do have certain forms of socialism in this country, like, for instance, the fire department and also school public education till age grade 12, which he wants to extend throughout college. So I think he's using some of the things that we already have in place as a means to explain it, and also to be provocative. And I think it's really gotten some good mileage that way.
What do you understand it to be? What is democratic socialism as you've understood it so far?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that I don't think, I think he's just using that as a catchphrase to get people's attention and probably anger some people. It makes people ask questions. I don't think it's an actual defined thing. I've never seen it anywhere. You know, he's basically inventing the term that he's putting out there. So he's trying to get people.
You really think
he's
inventing this, or do you think that it exists in other countries and people understand democratic socialism to be a particular philosophy and how it translates in a way that affects their everyday lives?
Well, like I said, I think he's pointing out countries that have these aspects of, you know, Germany, places in, Canada. But I don't think any of these places define it as democratic socialism. And also to point out that we don't have a democracy in this country. We have a republic. There's some certain democratic aspects to it, but it's really a republic. So, you know.
Let me ask, do you consider, despite the fact that he describes himself as a social democrat, or mm-hmm. democratic socialist, I should say, democratic socialist, do you see him being very different from the Democratic Party, or actually a part of the Democratic Party with perhaps a more definitive view on elements that he defines as democratic socialism?
Well, you know, that remains to be seen. I mean, I think he's been basically a party guy, and I'm just wondering how long, if he loses the nomination, is he going to just shut up and back Hillary Clinton, or is he going to continue pushing for these things? That's what my concern is. That's all I can say really about that.
Okay, one last question. What makes you say he's a party guy?
Well, because I think he's his foreign policy. I mean, I think he's very pro-Israel, and that his foreign policy remains to be examined.
Okay,
and I don't think he's so far different from Hillary Clinton on that.
So you expecting any day, you know, when the time comes, that he will identify more with the party central than with this concept of democratic socialism?
Well, I don't know. You know, it depends. You know, it could go either way. I mean, I think also, on the other side, I think Trump has a new, is egregious to some of the statements he's been making lately. He has a unique opportunity to actually expose some things. Whether that's going to happen remains to be seen.
Okay, so you're going to hurry up and wait.
Yeah, I guess so. It's still fairly early, but, you know, we'll see.
Things are likely to change.
All we could push these politicians to. I think he's, by introducing this stuff, he's saying to America, and obviously he's reaching a lot of people, that this concept, these concepts of socialism is not so foreign. I mean, we're using them. I mean, the word communism itself comes from community. It's like, let's forget about the isms and let's see if we can solve some problems in an intelligent way. I think that's part of what the message is.
Okay. Thank you so much, Sal, for your call. 888-874-4888. What is this thing? I still am trying to find out if you are any closer to a definition of what it is that Bernie Sanders is talking about, this concept of democratic socialism. How does it differ, say, from Hillary Clinton's version of just being a Democrat? I really would like to find out what you think about that, because although Bernie Sanders has applied this so-called philosophy to specific areas of our everyday lives that he thinks would be vastly improved with this concept of democratic socialism, I'm not so sure as to what it is, based on his own definition. I have an idea of what democratic socialism is, but I'm interested in how he sees it. But he has been very careful to not specifically define it. And I agree with Sal in a way. Perhaps this was one of the best ways that he could basically introduce the concept in a non-threatening way politically, but that he had to do it in order to distinguish himself from the from the Democratic field and certainly from the Republican field. But still, we have this thing. He's talking about democratic socialism, and people are saying he's talking about democratic socialism, but nobody has defined what it is. You know, every party, every political philosophy has some kind of guiding principles, and I'm not so sure that I understand from Bernie's point of view, because he's using the label democratic socialist, what exactly that is. Do you know what it is based on what he has said, what we have heard him say? Are you sure that this is what a democratic socialist is? And if not, just share your thoughts. 888-874-4888. You know, in political seasons, people do all kinds of things to fashion a profile and to make themselves distinguishable from the rest of the crowd. And in this regard, certainly he has a good thing going. He is the only person running so far who has labeled himself a democratic socialist. That's great. Now, what is it? What is a democratic socialist according to Bernie? And what are the democratic socialists saying about Bernie being a democratic socialist? And what does that mean for this election and beyond the election? How does democratic socialism, or how can democratic socialism, as he has defined it, benefit us all? Is it a real philosophy? Does it have a chance or a prayer of catching on? Is this something that we could wake up a week from now and guess what? There are so many more hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of democratic socialists. And is he, in fact, pulling off the political revolution that he says is necessary to transform America with this philosophy of democratic socialism? One would think that with this philosophy being so central to the political transformation of America, at least according to Bernie Sanders, he would take the time to explain what it is. From Texas, Winston, what are you thinking?
Hello, good afternoon, Sister Utri.
Good afternoon to you. Thank you.
First time caller here.
Thank you.
Not sure I can define it, but I will say, just to save Mr. Bernie's soul and body from personal experiences of Jamaican, we had democratic socialists in the 70s and 80s under a very progressive, duly elected government. And it was brought down, and after that point, boasted about it by American administration. So whatever this man running for high office is, you know, he should learn from we in the Caribbean, who have had all kind of twists and turns and been interfered with by outside forces. So it worries me to think that a man inside America hopes that he can get away with it.
Well, Winston, since you've had the advantage of experiencing democratic socialism, and I imagine you're talking about the government of Michael Manley, what is it?
Well, that was just an attempt at more self-determination based on a community approach to everything, education, and how we will interface with previous people who were our masters. You know, that's, as a common man in the community, that's all it was. You know, it couldn't be business same old, same old, because otherwise, you know, we knew where that took us. You know, and see, as an American by choice now, where America is heading, and, you know, something needs to change, but by adopting this, you know, democratic socialism, it's fraught with dangers from America itself.
So under democratic socialism, what, and you refer to the community, a shared community of interests here, and essentially it increases the power and authority of the people in the political and democratic, the political and economic spheres of life. How did that work out in Jamaica? What did Michael Manley do, and what was necessary to be done to make that change? In what fundamental ways did democratic socialism alter the power equation in Jamaica?
Well, economically, we wrestled some control of the economy within the country, our resources and that kind of thing. It was a hard battle because it turned around America, now the country's turned around and made us pay for that. But it was a success that, more equitable share of the country's resources came back to the people. And when I say more equitable, I'm only talking 51%. You know, you try telling an American that you're going to live with, 51% of any of your resources, see how far that goes. People start having a say on what their education system should consist of, instead of, you know, continuing to learn about some guy coming across the Atlantic and bumping into solid land, saying he discovered it, and that's making its way into your textbook. You know, that changed. It came from a grassroots. The people now said certain things don't make sense, and it ran across everything. People started question everything. You know, what is religion? Where did it come from? You know, our color, was this man, God, Jesus, come from which continent? And, you know, why are we walking around in an island with all these, you know, blue-eyed guy hanging from all over the place? You know, so I just see it, you know, as a common man, where the common man was able to question things and it made sense, or you went and got the answers, and that filtered through your society.
When Bernie Sanders says he is a democratic socialist, does that mean he's not a Democrat, a real Democrat?
I cannot comment on that because I'm too new an American to make sense of what is going on here. You know, sometimes I listen to Bernie and I like what he says, but I can't see how it's going to fit into this construct of American politics as it is. It's hard to believe what most people swallow here. And I use that word term, literally. You know, that wouldn't fly in most countries I know. So I just can't comment. I cannot make sense of this political system of America. Still learning.
Still learning here, too. Thank you so much, Winston, and welcome. I so appreciated your call today. Thank you.
Thanks, my sister. Bye.
And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it was in some way beneficial to you. Let me know. You can write me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking. Stay tuned. Coming up next, right here on PRN, Infectious Myth with David Crow. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Oh, you just might find that you're out of time and you're just too late.